Greg LaBelle is our go-to guy for analysis and evaluation of electoral campaigns, as well as the effectiveness of the people and processes that make up our government. With deep experience in both campaigning and academia, as well as interfaith activism, Greg brings the kind of broad perspective that the times call for. And so, Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Wild. It's good to see you again.
The human tragedy of Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine has captured the world's attention. People are finding many, many different ways to help as individuals. But Greg, what can the Biden administration actually do?
That is the question of the era, I think, right now. Of course, the defining factor here is what we're seeing in Ukraine is no longer limited to military or an international affairs issue or a political issue. This is a moral issue. And I think the world, generally the world, recognizes that. And the Biden administration, I think President Biden has been making efforts and many successful efforts to deal with it as best he can. This is a classic example, Walter, I think, of competing goods. And these are all, when I used to teach ethics and politics, this was something I tried to spend a lot of time with my students on. The competing goods are two. On the one side, we need to find a way to help Ukraine defend itself in effective ways and to stop the encroachment of Putin's Russia on a sovereign nation. That's a good. And I think most everybody agrees to that. The good on the other side, of course, is the strong imperative to avoid a direct confrontation with Russia, a nuclear power, and the possibility of what might only be called World War III. So these are competing goods that the president and his people are dealing with as best they can. And that's really, I think, the challenge here. I think that Biden has done a very good job at reestablishing America's role vis-a-vis NATO and Western Europe. We remember not that long ago, at the end of the last administration, where there was very little commonality between NATO, European Union, and the United States. Biden has managed to pull together a coalition that so far is holding together pretty well. He continues to move forward while always balancing those two, I think, those two competing goods. It's a tough spot, and I think that he and they are doing a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. I think the other factor that we have to consider here is, you know, we always talk about when America finds itself in a situation, an international situation such as this, there's that old rally round the flag thing where, you know, everyone sort of gets behind the president and so on and so forth. Not so much anymore. I mean, we listen to people who are actually complimenting and falling on the side of Putin, including some religious leaders in this country. Mm-hmm. So it's that aspect is not there for this president to make this an easier job.
How limited is a president in the ways that he can act without congressional approval?
We're finding that out as we go along. I think that the president has had his hand forced in some ways in this and in requirement that he has to figure out how much he can do, because, again, there is such a going to Congress, it's a combination of things in Congress. There are, as I said, there are those few who will oppose anything that this president puts forth. But I think there are other factors at well among other members. And again, as I said, it's the question of how far can we go before we bring about worldwide conflagration? Yeah. How close must we get to that line? And so there's no real agreement. And we all know that Congress is not at its best in terms of moving forward, making decisions, working together. So the administration has been sort of forced because of all of that, I think, to make unilateral decisions as to what has to happen. And I think that they have done a pretty good job of that. There certainly are more things that can be done. There may be things that could have been done earlier, but we'll leave that to the historians to sort out, I think.
You know, Joe Biden has a long history on the Foreign Relations Committee. Yeah. I remember seeing him in Davos, and people would be hanging on every word he said because they had such trust in him. He also has deep personal connections with our military. How do you see those things informing his response to the crisis in Ukraine so far?
You know, I think back, well, into our last discussion a few weeks ago when we talked about sort of Biden's first year in terms of domestic policy and politics. And one of the things we talked about at the time was that Joe Biden has a long history in the United States Senate, in the government, and so on and so forth, which is a good thing. He knows where a lot of the skeletons are hidden. He knows a lot of the players, but he doesn't know all of the players anymore. And I think we have to say once again that this is not a Congress that existed when Joe Biden was there.
Yeah.
So there's a limit to how valuable that experience is, which is why it's important that he surround himself, and he has, with people who have been members of the Senate, members of the House, since he left that body several years ago. So it's both a blessing and a curse for him to sort of sort out what's actually going on. And I think Joe Biden is naturally optimistic, which sometimes can get in the way of clear-eyed realism. And so he has to be constantly aware of that. And I think that generally he is, but I do think that that kind of trips him up on occasion.
There are clear religious and nationalistic themes that Russian rhetoric is raising in this attack. Do you think most Americans realize this, realize what's going on?
The polls indicate that most Americans do see what this is about. But there is a very vocal group or group of groups maybe in the country who, for whatever reason, refuse to either see it or acknowledge it. And I think as often it's acknowledge it as actually see it. We've got some media personalities, one in particular on Fox News, who seems to be lining up with Vladimir Putin on these issues. I don't understand what it's about unless, as rumors have persisted, that he actually is thinking about running for the Republican nomination for president in 2024, which is a frightening thought. I'm talking about Tucker Carlson, of course.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of factors that come into play. But generally, I think Americans do understand that they can't trust Vladimir Putin. And he's given us so many reasons over the last 4 or 5 weeks to reinforce that lack of trust with the obvious lies that he's told in the face of video proof in terms of what's going on in Ukraine. So I think generally there is an understanding of that, but it's not universal.
You mentioned the far right, religion-tinged political leaders in our government. How do you talk about being an American and being so, it seems like, wanting Putin to win?
I think there are two aspects of this Christian nationalism, as we've come to call it. And it is a question of how some of us can consider ourselves good Americans, good citizens, and be rooting for Putin. The other question, of course, is how can some of us consider ourselves good, faithful Christians and be doing some of the stuff and making some of the alliances that are being made? And that, I think, is the challenge. And it's a frightening one because I don't think we see it as much as we have seen actions by religious fanatics on the right in the past. I think back to the good old days, Welton, when you and I worked together. The Christian Coalition was out there. But the difference is, of course, everyone knew what the Christian Coalition was doing. Yeah. They made no bones about it. They were there. They were visible. I think that this movement of Christian national, this tightening of the links between this branch of Christianity, which I honestly am having more and more trouble even referring to as Christianity, and this extreme right political edge in the country, this increasing linkage between these two is frightening and is happening to a large extent, I think, under the radar screen. Mm-hmm. I was reading an article in the New York Times this week that I'm sure you've seen that talks about the use of praise music, of modern Christian praise music, in Trump events.
Yeah.
If there's been a president who is the antithesis of anything Christian in this country, I'm sorry, it's Donald Trump. So it does boggle the mind, and I don't begin to understand it. I often come down to an overly simplistic description of this as mass narcissism. I'm right, and the rest of you are all wrong, and no one's going to convince me otherwise. Yeah. There is a narcissistic aspect to this, but why it's linked itself the way it has with these conservative Christians and these, you know, anti-vaxxers and all this stuff, I don't I don't get it. I don't understand.
Yeah. How would you evaluate the first year of the Biden administration now?
What I started with last time when we were talking about domestic issues still relates. And this may sound a little facile, but I don't think it's facile at all. Biden gets big points up front for being the president of the United States, which means that Donald Trump is not the president of the United States. When I think back to what we have gone through in international affairs with the situation in Ukraine, I shudder to think where we would be if Donald Trump were still president. And I think it would be one extreme or another. I think it would be a Neville Chamberlain kind of situation where Trump says to Putin, take whatever you want in Western Europe. I really don't care. I just want you to be my friend. Versus the other extreme, which is I'm not even sure that we would be here to have this conversation. Yeah. And I don't think there's any middle ground with the possibility of a Trump administration. Yeah. So lots of points for the fact that he managed to become president and get that guy out of the way. I think that he's done a superb job, as good a job or better job than anyone could have expected, I think, in bringing this Western coalition together in dealing with the Ukraine situation. He has reestablished the role of the United States vis-a-vis NATO and Europe in general. That's all to the good. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the challenges for him now is to maintain focus. We love shiny objects in this country. And I think, you know, there will be a shiny object that comes around and the challenge for him and for the coalition, but him is the sort of the guy who pulled this coalition together, is to keep them and us focused on Ukraine for the long term. This is not going to end, and we know that. It's not going to end in a week or a month. Someone from the EU, I think, was on today saying, hey, let's go on for years. And we need to be ready for that and to figure out how to deal with it. I think the other interesting thing, and this is an incomplete, I guess, on his grade. The other thing we don't know yet is the rise of President Zelensky as a statesman, as the visible image of democracy in the world, is both surprising and really shows, one thing it shows us is that, you know, someone who was in the entertainment industry can actually be a remarkable international leader, unlike our recent experience. So Zelensky has sort of stepped into that role with remarkable skill and grace and intelligence. I think that one of the interesting things that the result of that is, in some ways, some of the more traditional leaders of Western democracies have been a little diminished just because of the situation. I think Boris Johnson, you know, he wasn't doing so well to begin with. He's just glad nobody's talking about the COVID frat parties anymore. Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz, of course, he's living in the shadow of Angela Merkel. But I think these leaders have sort of become less significant because this person from what I think most people would have called sort of a second-rate country has sort of captured the imagination of Western Democrats. The question I guess we have is, if I'm right about that, and if there is this diminution, what does it mean, and how does it affect the United States and the Biden administration in particular? And I don't think we know that yet. So there may be some sort of reordering of Western power structure going on here as a result. God, we're just in the era of reordering of structures, aren't we? I don't think there's anything in our lives that isn't in that realm right now. So I think a good job, but still incomplete.
You know, the campaign certainly raised up bipartisanship as a central value for this president. Has he been able to do anything substantial along those lines? And has he had some opportunities that he missed?
Well, I'm sure there have been opportunities that have been missed. But let's look at the infrastructure legislation. The infrastructure bill is something that we've been talking about this country for almost as long as I've been alive. Dwight Eisenhower did the last thing in this country that really had a major impact on infrastructure in this country with the interstate highway system. And we've been sort of, you know, flirting with it ever since. He got a bill passed. And of course, what's the first thing that the Republican leadership did? They criticized and ostracized some of their members who voted for it and then went out and took credit for the money that's coming to the states. When you're dealing with that kind of dishonesty and a refusal to play fair, it sort of ties your hands. It makes it really difficult to work in that system. And again, that's the thing I think that the Biden administration is still trying to figure out. So while Biden has certainly made mistakes, he has managed to get some stuff through. I was happy to see that the House and Senate both passed more funding for COVID relief, although, of course, they cut out $10 billion that was supposed to go to international relief. And I don't know why we think that suddenly, you know, borders are going to mean something to viruses again, because they don't. You know, there have been some successes. I think we have to really be realistic about our expectations and keep trying. And I think that's what they're trying to do right now.
Greg, what are the most important things this president needs to be doing right now?
The first thing that comes to mind is climate change. Mm-hmm. This is a problem that grows almost by the hour to this country and to the world. And it is a matter of international affairs as well as domestic policy. They're trying to sort of figure out how to deal with that. I think we have to look at cybersecurity. I know that there have been some successes in the last couple of weeks in getting some of big business to sit down with government and sort of think about cybersecurity in the face of this new crisis and threat that has suddenly sort of reared its head. And I keep going back to Ukraine. I sort of can't help it. But I think the other big thing that the Biden administration has to figure out is, how do we deal long term with a Russia that has become a rogue nation?
Yeah,
that will never be the same. Not certainly not as long as I'm on this earth, will not be the same.
Yeah.
There are factors that and these are in many ways interrelated. So, you know, it's a complicated set of problems. But meanwhile, again, we still have that challenge before us in how to deal with a Republican Party that doesn't seem to share a lot of the values that have been shared in this country before. I think of Ketanji Brown Jackson's hearings last week, the week before, and I think of Lindsey Graham, John McCain's best friend, and poor John McCain, asking Judge Brown Jackson, on a scale of 1 to 10, how faithful are you to your religion? And as a Protestant, could you be fair to a Catholic? How did we get here?
Yeah.
These are seemingly intractable problems that we have to figure out how to deal mm-hmm. with. And we're going to be walking in the dark. We're going to be stumbling in the dark, I think, in trying to figure these things out for a while.
Yeah. I know the last time we talked, you were of the thought that Democrats are in a very bad place as we look at coming elections. What would it take for them to turn something around?
Democrats tend to struggle with messaging. We know that.
Yeah.
So we just kind of start there. This is always the question. What is the message? How can we come up with a message that is clear and that I always like to say sort of strikes at the heart less than the head? Because that's how voters begin to make their assessments. There is sort of an emotional thing that has to happen that gets them to somehow connect to the message and to understand in an emotional sort of way as well, answer that seemingly selfish question, but self-interested question, I guess. But what's in it for me? How is my life going to change for the better if you folks remain in office or are elected to office? So these are the kinds of things that are faced. And this is, I can't believe I would ever say this, but a part of my hope rests with Donald Trump, because he alone has the potential to turn off droves of voters. And it looks like he hasn't figured that out. And I hope he never figures it out. He also has the ability, obviously, to drive up the participation of that segment of voters who still think that, you know, he won the election and so on and so forth. But I think increasingly we see evidence that his power is waning. That new TikTok thing, whatever it is that he set up, is a complete disaster. Yeah. It's a total disaster. And people are just sort of paying less and less attention to him. We see it in the polls as well. But Trump will not sit quietly by in the midterms. Yeah. So to some extent, I think that Donald Trump can do for the country what he did for Georgia in the special election right after the general a year or so ago. But it's we're fighting against history here. I mean, yeah. We know we're fighting against history. First midterms of any administration, with maybe like two exceptions, I think, since Roosevelt, have not been pretty for the party holding the presidency. So it's tough. It's really tough. The courts have actually, with regard to redistricting, the courts have done some fairly good work. They have thrown out some pretty egregious mm-hmm. proposals by Republican state legislatures and required a reassessment of that. So we're not in as bad a shape with that as we thought we would be. So that's a good thing.
What worries you the most about the state of our politics today?
Well, to be brief, And I've said this, I've told you this before, this is something that I used to tell my students early on in my classes with them. There was a time in political discourse in this country when if you disagreed with me, I thought that you were wrong. Now it seems that if you disagree with me, I believe that you are evil. Mm-hmm. And that has been driven primarily by the religious right over the years. I wish I could say that it has remained the mindset of just people on the right, but it has not. To a much smaller extent, there is some of that that exists on the left, happily not nearly as much, but it seems to be a given in our public discourse today. That in some ways is at the core of so many of the problems we've been talking about today.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University and Director Emeritus of GW's Native American Political Leadership Program and Semester in Washington Politics Program. And just like your host, so I can't say anything bad about it, he doesn't seem to be able to get this retirement thing quite right, as he now the interim director of the AT&T Center for Indigenous Politics and Policy. I understand. Greg
yes, you do.
also worked in several presidential campaigns and has held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance. Thank you for taking time for State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure and an honor, Welton, to spend time with you. Thank you.